Welcome back. This is Talking History, and we're talking with historian Mary Dudziak, the author of a brand new book, Exporting American Dreams, Thurgood Marshall's African Journey. We know that, obviously, his career does not end after Kenya. Marshall ends up on the Supreme Court and is there for a number of years. Could you tell us a little bit about how maybe he looked back on his African journey in those years when he was on the court, and how he maybe thought about what his role had been in this series of momentous events in a land far away from the United States?
Yeah, well, we might have wanted to see him perhaps play a role as a vocal human rights supporter, which would then make him a vocal critic of the Kenya government, right? Because Kenyatta, after becoming Kenya's first president, one of the first things he does is gets the constitution amended to make it easier to amend. And basically, law in Kenya has largely been a tool of, especially during the later Kenyatta and then Moi presidencies, where you basically had authoritarian figures in power, big man politics in Kenya, as you have in other African countries. And so law and the legal system ends up becoming a tool of the executive. And that's certainly not anything that was within Marshall's imagination. It was one of the reasons his sensibility as an American limited his ability to sort of look forward in time. So we might have thought, well, maybe he would be, you know, a human rights activist criticizing Kenya, but that doesn't happen at all. He goes to Kenya in 1978 to attend Kenyatta's funeral as a representative of the U.S. government. And he comes back and he says, you know, the Bill of Rights I wrote for Kenya was working very well. And what I do in the book is as I tell that story, I tell another story of Kenya's leading novelist, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who was in detention in Kenya without charges at the same time that Marshall was there. Something that, you know, did Marshall know and not incorporate this into his sensibility? Did he know and not? I don't know, but basically he was in a position that he can't, you know, he can't not have been aware of the terrible rights violations that were happening in Kenya. But what becomes interesting then is that as Marshall is aging on the Supreme Court, you know, he's finally in the court and then not able to achieve his vision of justice on the court as the court is shifting to the right. And by the middle of the 1970s, it's clear that there's just not a future in terms of his ability to achieve what he would have liked on the Supreme Court. And so then he looks back at Kenya as this idealized moment. It becomes essentially a memory of an aging man, when he thinks about Kenya. Kenya for him is always frozen in time in this snapshot in 1963, the moment the flag is raised and power is transferred from the British to the Kenyans, and so he took so much pride in being part of that moment that that's the Kenya that he saw. It was as if he wasn't able to see anything else, as if he needed to hang on to this vision as, you know, he continued to live out a life that became so difficult, I think, as the court turned away from his own vision.
I'd love to ask you about, and sort of thinking about Marshall's impact, I'd love to ask you about a sentence at the beginning of the book, and I'll just read it and then I'll explain why it struck me in a certain way. You write, "It is a story," meaning the story of Marshall and Africa, "it is a story of a man at work in the world at a time when that work held global meaning." And I found this sentence particularly striking, in part, I think, because of the implication that working in the world, to use your term, may have lost some of its appeal. I wonder if you think that is the case, and if so, why? And then maybe even if you might speculate a little bit on who's carrying on Marshall's work today. in the world, his ideals today in the world?
In some ways, for me, that sentence is pulling in to the Thurgood Marshall narrative everything I wrote about in Cold War Civil Rights.
Okay.
His work in the world held global meaning of a particular kind. I mean, the sentence goes beyond that, but that's part of it. This was a moment when race in America was a major global story, that when people in other countries thought about what the United States was, one of the things they thought about was the legacy of race discrimination. And what does democracy mean? Who is America? If within the United States, children are segregated, people can't vote because of their skin color, et cetera. And so race in America was such a central global narrative. Marshall is then a part of that, both because he's trying to change the law at home. And then when he goes to Kenya in 1963, especially, at this very troublesome moment in a crisis about the image of the United States around the world because of events, the violence against civil rights demonstrators, Marshall was the embodiment of a story that the United States government had been trying to tell for years, that African Americans can achieve things in the United States, and here you could see it in Marshall. So that's part of his, an embodiment of this story of racial progress,
right,
that the U.S. government had been trying to tell the world so many years before there had really been meaningful progress on the civil rights front. This particular story, I mean, I think work in the world always has meaning. But that particular story changes, at some point along the way. And part of it's because other issues drive the U.S. image around the world more centrally than American race discrimination, like Vietnam. Part of it's that international affairs and the U.S. role in the context of the Cold War becomes established and consolidated by the 70s and after in a way that it wasn't when the U.S. was first in this position as seeing itself as the leader of the free world after World War II. So the U.S. is more concerned about its image during these years of consolidating its role. And the U.S. seems not to care about its rights violations and its image around the world in later years, for example, during the past, previous 8 years.
Right.
So when rights violations by the U.S. were clearly an issue, and why don't we think that matters to our national security the way it mattered to U.S. national security and foreign relations in the context of the early years of the Cold War? But, to sort of get back to your point about, where do we see it now? Barack Obama's election is a really interesting moment for many reasons. But one thing that's interesting about it is this sort of coda to the story of the impact of American racism on world opinion about the United States. Race in America had been a central narrative about what the United States was as a nation,
right,
that then gets to some degree in a limited way fixed in the 60s. It's so interesting now that race in America is again a narrative of what America is all about, but it's flipped and changed in a way that just wasn't within the country's grasp in the 1960s. And I actually sort of did a little blog writing about, that now Barack Obama was the image of America. I think it sort of turns things around and maybe allows us to go back to a broader conversation about the way that embracing equality and going beyond that, embracing rights, living up to the country's ideals. So it's not just who he is as a person, but it's also his ideology and his argument that we're stronger at home when we protect what our core values are. And by the way, our core values are include individual rights, and that includes how we treat detainees, how we treat people that we're afraid of. So in some ways, Obama's election brings us all the way back to this sort of struggle over American identity that happened in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and that Thurgood Marshall also sort of plays this role in. And by his election, Obama basically places us in a new space, enabling us to not only have a new conversation with the world, but with ourselves.
And there's also the story in here, in fact, in the book itself, of Obama's father benefiting from the airlift in the 1960s, which also I thought that was a fantastic anecdote that sort of brought me from today to the past. Do you have any sense of how Kenyans today remember Marshall and how do they view his contribution to their history?
Well, the Kenyans that I talked to about it, a lot of people don't know about Marshall's role.
Okay.
But folks who do know about his role think of him as, you know, the founders in Kenya, the nationalists who worked towards Kenya's independence are thought of in the way we sometimes idealize and turn into icons, our own framers. And so Marshall is thought of as this, you know, honorable person who worked together with Kenya's framers. Now Kenya has, you know, issues about historical memory. You know, there is a politics of memory in Kenya. You know, who's included within the group that's going to be held up in honor? So that's a contentious issue in Kenya today. But you know, for the folks who know about Marshall's role, because he worked with Kenyatta, and he worked with those founding leaders, you know, he's a person of great honor.
Mm. Well, I must say, in reading this book, I came away with a greater sense of Marshall's achievements. And so in that way, his stature grew for me as well as the human side. And to me, that is the mark of a fantastic book, one that allows us to both appreciate the human side and the larger global implications of one of the most important figures of the 20th century. And so we're very happy that you were able to join us today, Mary, to talk about your brand new book, Exporting American Dreams. And we hope to have you back again when the next book comes out.
Thank you. I'd be happy to come.
Great.